This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I mean, how old were you when she was popular?
I mean, I've seen The Bodyguard, so...
Yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate that was associated with Whitney Houston.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Adele of the education policy world, Adam Emerson.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's great to be here.
Adam, you are new to our listeners, at least on the podcast. Adam is our new, what do we call you, director of our parental choice program?
I think you called me the school choice czar.
Which is a little, doesn't work well, you know, because school choice is supposed to all be about freedom, and you don't really think about that when you think about a czar. Anyways, among other things, Adam blogs for us at the new Choice Words blog, part of the edexcellence.net suite of offerings. And it is sweet, Adam.
Thank you.
You've been blogging a lot. You blog like every day.
Every day, almost.
Oh, my gosh. It's amazing. There's that much in school choice to cover, huh?
There is that much in school choice to cover state to state, nationwide, D.C., and there's any platform that's going to generate a lot of news and a lot of coverage on this, so it's going to keep me busy.
You know, 2011 might have been the year of school choice, but 2012 is the year of the school choice blog. Ba-boom. Hey, a lot to cover here today. Things are happening. You know, we definitely have weeks where we're like, okay, what are we going to cover this week? Well, not now. All right. Things are happening. Budgets are being proposed. Waivers are being given out. Policies are being discovered. I mean, this is exciting stuff. So let's get started. Ty, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Last week, the Obama administration announced that it would waive NCLB's requirements for 10 states. With the next deadline for waiver applications less than 2 weeks away, should the remaining states be scrambling to apply or saying, thanks, but no thanks?
No thanks. Now, look, so I've been writing about this and speaking a bunch as well. And what I see in here is that the administration, they promised a mile, and at the end, they gave an inch. I mean, there was not significant flexibility given over the heart of No Child Left Behind, which is the school rating system. It's true that they got rid of AYP, and it's true that the schools no longer have to meet 100% proficiency by 2014. But when you get into the guts of what the federal government approved, there's still a lot of complexity in there that states have to use. They are not really moving away from subgroup accountability. They're not really moving away from this whole idea of timelines and getting so many kids to proficiency, and this cohort of kids has to do better than last year's cohort of kids. The states asked for much more flexibility than was actually given in the end.
And it is interesting that you are starting to see some states react to round one and where they're starting to weigh whether they are going to dive into round two in some ways. The feedback they're getting is becoming invaluable. Some schools are actually trying to weigh the cost and benefits of actually going for the waiver as opposed to not. So it's becoming an eye-opening experience in many ways just from round one alone.
Yeah, I mean, you got New Hampshire and Maine that are saying that they're not going to apply, at least not right now. We'll see if some others drop out. Look, you know, they've probably already done a lot of work on their applications at this point, so, you know, not applying might not be an attractive option. And there is some real flexibility in there, you know, getting rid of the highly qualified teachers mandate, being allowed to not do supplemental services, which wasn't working out very well, and use the money for else. So, you know, there's still going to be pressure to apply, but I think this notion that this process is fixing No Child Left Behind or fulfilling the Obama administration's campaign promise to fix No Child Left Behind, it's just laughable because it does not go nearly enough. It just goes a little smidgen in the direction of flexibility.
Exactly.
Okay, Ty, topic number two.
A Chicago charter network is catching heat for pocketing almost $400,000 over several years in fees from students and their families for minor infractions. Is this a valid disciplinary strategy or an ethics scandal that could give charters a black eye?
All right, what do you think here, Adam? I mean, first of all, what kind of infractions are we talking about? Do you know?
These range wildly. This is anywhere from failing to sit up straight to bringing potato chips into the classroom all the way to serious behavioral issues. But it adds up. This isn't necessarily infraction by infraction. You get 4 demerits, you have to pay $5. If you get something like 12 detentions, you're going to have to sit in a behavioral modification class for $140. So depending on the infraction, depending on what starts lining up, it could start add up. And this is a charter school that serves primarily disadvantaged kids. It's a high-performing charter school, and one the Chicago mayor, Rahm Emanuel, has gone to great lengths to talk up considerably. However, I think it could give it a black eye. This could be easily seen in the public judgment as nickel and diming students. There is something to be said for putting some skin in the game. The folks at Noble Charter Network have basically said this this goes to those who might generate the costs of actually observing the detention area, the observing the classroom, going on those who actually would generate the costs.
So part of this is a behavior modification kind of thing. So KIPP gives out KIPP dollars. That's sort of a carrots approach. And it sounds like Noble Street uses a stick approach and says, we're going to actually fine you for misbehaving. But then there's this actual other component that says, if you've got to sit in school suspension and we've got to pay somebody to watch you, we're going to ask your parents to help pay for that. Because, you know, you're the ones that got yourself into this trouble. So, which is interesting. And I know it's easy to ridicule this, but these are high-performing schools. They're trying to teach a whole new set of behaviors and disciplines to these kids. And, you know, the $400,000 number, over how many years? Let's say it's over 4 or 5 years, it's $100,000. I mean, I don't know if it's actually that much money. I mean, it's like Diane Ravitch has been saying, this Chetty study that said, well, you know, great teachers add up to $250,000 more in lifetime income for the classroom. You say, well, you do the math and there's 25 kids in the classroom and lifetime earnings, people are going to work 30 or 40 years, then it's actually not a lot of money. So same deal here. It sounds like a big figure, but I don't think it's a huge amount of money. And part of it's going to subsidize the programs that basically kids are paying for their own detention. I don't think that's crazy.
Charters have enough political complications as it is, though, and there is a public expectation that detention doesn't necessarily come with a checkbook. So I think charter school policies like this should weigh carefully going forward. I see the argument. I see the benefit of having families put some skin in the game. Mm-hmm. But I think they need to proceed cautiously with this.
Adam, now you're new to Fordham. I want you to know that if you have to do detention, it's coming right out of your paycheck.
All right.
So let me just be very clear on those expectations right now.
So this is a real world policy.
Exactly. All right. Topic number three.
On Monday, President Obama announced a budget proposal with increased federal education spending, but no new funding for the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program. What does this mean for school vouchers in Washington and the school choice movement nationwide?
It means that Barack Obama is not your friend when it comes to private school choice. This is amazing to me, Adam. I mean, he and Boehner went toe-to-toe on this issue last year, the House Speaker, Republican John Boehner, and Boehner pushed as a part of the budget deal more than anything else for this one rinky-dinky little program.
You know, $20 million.
I mean, budget dust, right? And Obama agreed to reauthorize the program, and now he's just going to take the money back out again? It's amazing. You know, the folks at Heritage have been pointing this out too, which is kind of fun. At the same time he's taking away these $10,000 scholarships for poor kids, he's offering up to something like $12,000 subsidies for people willing to buy the Chevrolet Volt electric car. You know, so it's okay, we're going to subsidize rich people to buy this eco-friendly car, but not poor kids to go to high-quality private schools. This is nuts.
And this is effectively trying to cap and trying to contain a program where there is outsized interest among DC parents on. In fact, they just held an application event just last week, gave it very little marketing. 700 families showed up. There was a 60% increase in enrollment following the reauthorization last year. So there is outsized interest. Clearly there is demand, and there is demand to see funding for it. We are coming up on an election year, and it is disappointing to see them trying to contain the expansion of this program. And we're having conversations that we had years ago.
Yeah.
It's time to move on, and it's time to see how we can keep creating good policy out of this program. This clearly has a lot of interest to folks out there.
You know, I know a lot of our folks listening and friends in the charter school movement and the school choice movement, you know, people might say, hey, I really like charter schools. I don't like vouchers because they're not held accountable or because of the religious thing. But here the facts are very clear to me. And I have to admit, my bias is more towards charter schools. But the evidence is clear. The voucher programs are incredibly effective at both raising achievement and especially boosting high school graduation rates. And the evidence for this voucher program is, frankly, much stronger than we have for charter schools in general. So, you know, on the evidence point, at least, you got to say, look, this is working. And it's true that the individual schools aren't held accountable, and I would prefer them to be more so, but the program's been evaluated. As a whole, it's having an impact. Personally, I have no problem with using public money to send kids to good Catholic schools or religious schools. You know, this is a crazy fight. You know, the president spends $64,000 a year to send his girls to Sidwell Friends. That is not an option for many of his neighbors in D.C. It's surprising to me that this is something he wants to take on.
And as far as accountability goes, as the program grows, and as any voucher program grows in any state across the nation, the conversations we need to be having next are accountability and accountability done right. There is something to be said for the parents' choice, but obviously sometimes parents can make bad choices, and it is good but to make sure that good choices are available to them, good options are available to them. We shouldn't be having conversations that we had in the 1990s mm-hmm. and 7 years ago and 5 years ago, and Obama's trying to keep us back there.
I did notice, Ty, that the NEA was very supportive of the president's budget for education. You wouldn't think it's an election year, do you? He's not worried about the turnout of his base at all. Do you think that's what's going on here?
Certainly could factor in, yeah.
Okay, that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Great playing, Adam. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Did you watch the Grammys the other night?
I did. Oh, sad.
What is up with the Whitney Houston thing?
Yeah. No, it's very tragic. Beautiful voice.
I know. She really just struggled with this for so many years.
Yeah, and I thought everybody said the same thing. You thought she was out of the woods. She gave that great Oprah interview not too long ago where she seemed to have beaten it.
Yeah.
You know, so what would happen?
You know, it's a reminder. I mean, I've been reading some stuff lately about how the crime rate and drug abuse rate, you know, all of that, those indicators have gone so much better. And you think back to the early 90s, mid-90s when stuff was so bad, mm-hmm. and the crack cocaine epidemic. And, you know, and here's this reminder of somebody who still, you know, after what, 15, 20 years, was still in the grip of it. Really sad to watch that play out.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, on to more positive notes.
Yes.
School principals, Eric Hanushek.
Yes.
What you got for us?
We got the new Hanushek study out by Calder. Examines principal quality and principal turnover. So Eric and colleagues analyzed roughly 7,000 principals, looked at their performance from 1995 to 2001 in Texas. So that was about 28,000 annual observations of principals. They estimated principal value added via student learning gains during a principal's tenure at a school, and the attempt to control for school level factors that might confound their results. Bottom line, principal turnover patterns basically showed substantial variations among principals, just like we have with teachers. Principal in the top 16% of the distribution will lead annually to student gains that are roughly 0.05 standard deviation or more, higher than average for all students in the school. So that's kind of a macro technique there. Further variance among leaders increases with the school poverty rate. So in other words, the skills spread is even more pronounced in poor schools. They also find that the least and most effective principals tend to leave schools. And again, this is more pronounced in the poor schools. So principals in your second and third quartiles are more likely to remain in their positions than those in the bottom quartile. So we've got another dance of the lemons, this time with principals. They also found a substantial portion of ineffective principals in high poverty schools take positions in other schools and districts. Obviously, it's really hard to separate the difficulty of the school environment here from the quality of the principal, which is going to be a challenge in a study like this. But one thing that's safe to say, which they sort of conclude with, is that the principal labor market is not weeding out our worst leaders.
So this is, as I understand it, the first time anyone's ever been able to demonstrate the value-added impact of principals.
Yes, it's mostly qualitative if you look at the principal literature.
Yeah,
so.
Which is interesting. You know, this finding that it seems like principals matter more for the high poverty schools. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it could be that the principal skills are different. You either have really good people or really bad people taking those jobs, or it could just be that, you know, in an affluent school, you can have a big dodo as principal, and they're still going to do pretty good.
Pretty good.
You know, whereas it, you know, if you have a bad leader in a high poverty school, it's going to really show up.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it's fascinating, really, and it's intuitive, you know, that the same thing we see, that it matters with teachers, it matters with principals, the quality of a principal leader, and these folks get shuffled around.
Now, what about, did they look at any of the qualifications, you know, age, experience, master's degrees, any of those sorts of things?
Yeah, I mean, I actually did not zero in. There was a section that I did not, I'll admit to reading this report in 5 minutes, but a press release, as I recall, said they looked at master's credentials and stuff you can measure and couldn't feasibly say, you know, this is what matters,
you know, that
some of this stuff is just, it's a crackshoot.
I'm like a prosecutor, Amber. I never ask a question I don't know the answer to. And the answer is, those things don't matter.
Okay. So you read it too.
Yeah.
Good.
I mean, this is, you know, this is the same finding as we see in teachers, that when you are able to look at effectiveness in terms of achievement, then those other stuff that we've been trying to measure forever don't seem to matter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, principals with credentials, without credentials, age, experience, race, gender. I mean, none of that stuff, they couldn't get a grip on any of that. I mean, the good news, in some ways it's good news for those of us who believe that we need more flexibility in our hiring, you know, so that, you know, don't rule people out because they don't have a master's degree in administration or they don't have 7 years of teaching experience. On the other hand, it's hard for, you know, people who do hire principals. There's not much guidance here in terms of, hey, here's what you want to look for.
Right. Yeah, and I think TFA, and I mean, they're trying to do this with teachers, right? What's that sort of, what's grit mean? You know, if we think grit is important, how do you spot that in an interview when you're screening these folks? I mean, wow. I mean, it's same dilemma with principals in terms of what are those intangible things that we think might matter, and how do we measure that and credibly, you know, and think it's reliable. So,
right. What's the secret sauce? You know, people are often trying to figure out the secret sauce here at Fordham. We will not tell people. We will not tell them it is secret.
Yeah.
We're not going to just give away all our secrets, are we, Amber?
That's right. We've got lots of them around here. No. Yeah.
All right. So, Amber, we are into the pop quiz section of your part of the show.
We are. So, last week, you may recall that I asked which country spends less than 40%. In other words, the teachers spend less than 40% of their working time actively teaching. So, they're doing other stuff.
This is the slacker rating.
Yes. Teachers here, by the way, spend about 60% of their time teaching. So, I asked whether that was Japan, England, the Netherlands, or Germany. Our listeners, about 25%, answered correctly. And the correct answer is, what do you think?
I would have guessed the Netherlands.
That would be wrong. It is Japan. Japan!
Japan. Slackers in Japan.
Right. That's like, makes you just kind of scratch your head on that one, doesn't it?
Well, aren't they famous for their whole lesson study thing? They spend a lot of time talking about
point.
Their lessons.
Yes,
and they have huge classes. I mean, this is the Asian model, right?
That's right.
Tons of kids, but more time preparing.
That's right. You get two huge classes and then lots of time for planning. That's right.
By the way, 60% for American teachers? Doesn't even that seem kind of low? I mean, what are they spending 40% of their time doing?
I was there. Bus duty, lunch duty, you know.
recess
whatever.
Crowd control, parking lot control.
Everything.
All right. So what do you have for us this week?
So this week, I thought, since Adam was here, I'd give us a charter and choice question. This is softball for those of us who know the charter school world. What percentage of all public school students attend a charter school? This is from 08-09. So that would be 0.7%, 2%, 3%, or 5%.
Ooh, and the wrinkle of going back to 08-09, this is a little bit of a challenge.
That's a little tough, yeah.
Yeah, but do the math in your head.
It's gone up quite a bit. It's gone up right now,
right,
back
08-09.
In 08.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
That's the newest data we have, which is always sad.
So where people go to vote?
So they go to www.edexcellence.net/podcast.
To clear my head, telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that? What up with that? Yes,
sir. Welcome, Chris.
Great to be here.
Are you torn up about Whitney Houston also?
Not really.
I mean, how old were you when she was popular?
I mean, I've seen The Bodyguard. So,
yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate. That's all associated with Whitney Houston.
There was a time she was amazing. Well, we will miss her here in the show. I wonder if we ever used a Whitney Houston song as part of Amber's Research Minute. We probably did, but I can't think of what it was at this point.
Should we start now?
Well, you don't do the song anymore, Adam. We've moved past that, the end of an era. Okay, so, Chris, what you got for us this week? Something good, I hope.
Yeah, for sure. There's a litany of hogwash reasons against using more thorough and statistically-based methods to evaluate teachers. But to me, it seems like the real reason behind all these facades is because there's a good number of teachers who just can't take criticism very well. Not all teachers, by any means, but you know the type. The teachers whose job satisfaction comes not from being in the classroom every day, but from being the smartest person in the classroom every day. Take Willie Vega, for example, a 44-year-old teacher at the High School of Commerce in Springfield, Massachusetts. After reviewing his evaluation during a meeting last December, Mr. Vega became enraged, grabbing the review from the vice principal, stabbing it with a pen, and crumpling it up. He proceeded to stand up and punch the vice principal in the face, causing her to fall from her chair.
Her?
Her. When she attempted to flee the office, Mr. Vega blocked the door, forcing her to use a portable radio to call the school police officer. What's up with that? All this over a simple evaluation? I mean, while the review did point to several areas of weakness in Mr. Vega's pedagogy, it certainly wasn't going to lead to him being fired. Well, that is, until he ripped it up and punched his superior in the face. But the best part is that when he finally faced a judge, he denied the entire incident even took place. What then, Mr. Vega, would explain the hospital report indicating the vice principal was treated for a contusion on her face? Wait, don't tell me. It was probably a self-inflicted wound. Just another case of a rogue administrator unjustly wielding power to have an innocent teacher fired over a petty personal grudge.
Wow. I mean, you know, what I really find mystifying here is that we know that, at least right now, teacher valuations don't matter at all in most places, right? What's the worst thing that happened?
And this probably wasn't going to matter either.
That's the most baffling thing about this, is that all he had to do is sit there, take his licks.
And his 4 stars.
Yeah. Or 3, maybe. That might have been what he was upset about. He got 1 less than he thought he deserved. But, you know, I just... Maybe they are doing something right in Springfield, Massachusetts, and he was actually worried about being fired.
Maybe. I mean, this is always striking to me. I remember reading a while ago this author writing about soft America versus hard America, and that, you know, hard America in the business world or in the real world where a lot of, you know, people get fired, things are tough, you know, you got to perform or not, versus soft America in education, academia, and other, you know, this is hard. We're trying to make education be more like hard America, and it's not going to go over easy. I mean, people are going to be told that, hey, you kind of stink as a teacher. And if you don't get better, you're out of here. No one wants to hear that.
No, not until, you know, there's some definitive way of proving that you are a bad teacher. And, you know, for a lot of these people, they won't accept anything.
I wonder how this guy takes it when people break up with him. Probably not well either, huh?
Fisticuffs.
Yeah. Anger management class, my friend. Anger management. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And remember, if you like what you heard during the podcast, head to www.edexcellence.net/podcasts to find links and more about this episode and to vote on Amber's pop quiz. It's a lot of fun. You should do it. Till next week.
I'm Adam Emerson.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.